Okay, ladies and gentlemen, if I could have your attention. Good evening and welcome to the London School of Economics. My name is Ricky Burdett, director of the LSE Cities Programme. And I'm delighted on behalf of the LSE and the Royal Academy to introduce this evening, which is a lecture by David Adjaye as part of the series on design and dwelling. And I think, as some of you know, this is the third in a series of lectures given this term, addressing many of the issues that really intersect between society at large and the design disciplines. It's a very important event for me because this will be my last event as director of the Cities Programme. And in many ways, one of the things I think we've been trying to do here with my colleagues over the last 6 or 7 years is to try and make that link between social issues and physical issues. And we've been trying to do that not just at the level of architecture, but very much at the level of cities. And I think this series of talks is very much trying to bring these two worlds together through that one unit, that one center of habitat, which is the home, the house, the dwelling. And the reason we've asked David Adjaye to speak is not just because he's one of the best architects I know in the world at the moment, not just because he's young, I've decided, because he's just good, but because I think he has been addressing this issue of the home very patiently over the sort of brief years of his profession, as is witnessed by his incredibly rigorous and, I think, beautiful work. And why that's important to those of us who are addressing issues of the city scale, such as London. I've talked in several introductions here about the big challenges which are facing us, particularly in the Thames Gateway. Why I think what David is bringing to us, which is here, is that very simple thing that sometimes those of us who get so involved in the issue of planning, so involved with the issues of numbers, the sheer quantities of 700,000 more people moving into London in the next 10 years, is that simple issue of beauty. What is it that makes an environment what it is? And I think what also interests me is the fact that I realize that what we're engaged in at this sort of bigger urban level is a project. It actually is a project. And the construction of a house, the construction of a room, the moving out from a series of rooms into a building which might become a library, like David's idea store, is exactly the process that I think we need to go through very patiently and with a degree of introspection and analysis when one goes from detail to city. So in that sense, I think David's work, at one level more difficult to explain in the context of what we've been doing over the years, is very, very apposite and requires a degree of thinking and evaluation which is extremely important for all of us. There's another dimension where I think David's work is essential in terms of engaging with us in the shift from, let's call it, the quantitative to the qualitative, is because we've been fellow travelers over the last year or two in sitting on some of these endless committees to do in the Thames Gateway, where one is sort of very much appalled at the little and low quality of aspiration and low quality of design thinking that is embedded in the decision-making process. And that is very much, as far as I understand it, David's spur for tonight's talk. He's, of course, interested in architecture and form, but he's also interested in the social form of a city as complex and as diverse as London. One of the big issues, of course, in intervening, say, in the excluded areas of East London, is the problem of how do you intervene with money in an area which is fundamentally poor at many levels, environmentally and also socially. And the way he will talk about his work is very much by thinking of his projects in different parts of London as intervening and changing, modifying, and having action upon the environments in which they sit. So in that sense, David, I'm delighted you're talking on that. It very much is at the heart of these key issues of linking the physical to the social, which interests us at the LSE. And would you all join me in welcoming David Adjaye to the LSE? Thank you.
Richard, thank you very, very much for that introduction. Can you all hear me? The mic, is that? It's a real pleasure to really talk about my work for the first time in this manner. It is something that has always been at the heart of how I've been conceiving the sort of dwelling projects that I've been doing, and I think dwelling is the operative word. And it's a sort of maybe a slight sort of problem from the way in which things get published and things get looked at, that there's been a kind of sense of maybe a sort of one-off spectacle nature to the way in which the work might have sort of initially appeared. But at the heart of it, there's been a discussion that I've been having about what it is to make homes, to make new topologies in the city now, and how does one actually use the city as a very physical fact that you intervene in, make modifications, make adjustments, recalibrate. And I think this moment is very opportune for me in the sense that I'm now obviously very fortunate enough to be doing public projects, which are another entirely new area, which I'm extremely excited about. But it also offers a moment of reflection on these dwelling projects as we change from these very small sort of calibrations to much bigger work. But what I want to do today is to really talk about 8 projects which go from west to east, sort of the other way around to the sunrise, I guess, and to really chart an idea of a sort of the affluence of the city and how that operates, and the ideas of luxury and pleasure now, and to the East End, where I think new ideas about the artisan are being rediscovered, and how to appropriate parts of the city which had different topologies, you know, much more industrial topologies, and how they become fused with this idea of the sort of work-live configuration, which we're still trying to work out and recalibrate. Those 8 projects, sort of oddly enough, when we sort of made a little map of, sort of graphic map of London, we realized that it's east to west, but it's sort of central. But in a way, it's West London, North London, and East London. I'm going to start straight away with the first project. And this was made a few years ago, and on one of the most, I guess, distinguished streets, Kensington Palace Gardens. Where am I? This is Kensington Palace Gardens here. This is Hyde Park. And in a way, what you have is an extraordinary sort of avenue with fantastic villas, which makes a completely different typological grain to the sort of West London terrace type which sort of surrounds it, and in a way makes it a very interesting sort of filter between the park and the sort of dense grain of the urban fabric of the city. I mean, if you ever get a feel like walking down here, this is a very interesting walk to do architecturally, just to kind of note the sort of topology of those large villas, palaces really, that sort of line that street. What's very curious is that during the war, several of these sites were bombed, and this site and these were remade. This is a Seyfert's building, and this is the site of the project that I'm making. This became the Czech embassy, this is the Russian embassy, this is the Indian embassy. And that's the building there. That's the entrance to Kensington Palace Gardens. And it's the only block which became a residential, and a residential building which wasn't really about the patronage of the royal family. It's still in the crown sort of possession in terms of land, but it's held by a separate company, and what they've done is to have long leases on these apartments. And these apartments, I mean, there are only 4 apartments in this block, but what was kind of interesting was this moment of this sort of this privileged street, really, sort of becoming a place where a new wealth could suddenly also sort of take part in that. And what was interesting when we were asked to make this project, which was incredibly different to everything we'd been doing, was to try and really kind of talk about what was going to be the driver here. Because what I very much was very interested in exploring is not a sort of personal agenda about necessarily what I want to say about the person that's living there, but essentially more about how does one negotiate the idea of a kind of luxury? How does one discuss the idea of a sort of new way of making a space, which uses a new set of codes to kind of describe a different condition. So this is not necessarily, for me, about a sort of, they are exquisitely made, but it's not about a kind of tastefulness for me in this project, and I kind of want to make that quite clear. This is the Czech embassy, so this was built at the end. So it's quite extraordinary. You get this, which is actually a very interesting building. Obviously, because it's an embassy, they have autonomy and built this fabulous building with this residential thing behind it. And you have the street with this nature of villas, fantastic boulevard with trees. And essentially what I had to do was to develop onto this the Seifertz building. I'll show you more images, it'll become clearer. I was given the penthouse, the top of that. And what was ironic about that was that originally the penthouse was not conceived as a penthouse as we traditionally conceive it. It was more sort of not caretaker, but a sort of looking after sort of flats, two small apartments which sat on top and were sort of linked to the major primary sort of first and second floor grand sort of apartments which were in the building. So one had to sort of take a condition which was something very simple and really recalibrate it into a kind of new landscape. And in a way, that plate, this bit sitting on top of three floors, becomes the sort of profile of what one was trying to do. And in it, what it became was an exploration of proportions, of geometry, as a way of configuring some kind of meaning to the things that were actually going to be happening in this house. This person actually collected a lot of antiquities art, and also as a way of making a hit against the horizontality, which a beautiful horizontality of this block, with a kind of figure which would articulate the different spatial sequences that are made. So this idea of making this horizontality, which looks to the city and looks to the park, but is articulated with material into a series of very specific spaces. The plans, which I don't need to labor on, but just to quickly talk about, essentially the roof becomes this landscape of lanterns. The plan divides very simply into a public part and a private area, and two materials are essentially deployed, stone, and it becomes an exploration of stone and a study of materiality, which is more, I guess, in line with the thinking of Semper, Gottfried Semper's work, turn of the century, really, in a way that one tries to explore a material physicality and the potential of the material to make all the conditions and to define the kind of experience of the space. So you have stone which is cut in different thicknesses to deal with flooring, walling, and ceiling, sort of increasing from 30 millimeters to 5 millimeters, which is bonded to honeycomb to make the ceilings. And then you have different timbers used here, but the timber isn't just lined in that conventional sense. The idea of a singular lump of wood and then its book matching is then sort of revealed in each one of these as a kind of specific experience about materiality and material calibration of space. Some of the sections drawn up, this is the main living room, sort of fireplace and extension terrace with a sort of cover. Here concerns being about dissolving the interiority and the exteriority and connecting it to the park. A library, sort of roof terrace, bedroom. And this is the building, and that's our project here with these lanterns. And we had to, these are these sort of grand apartments with duplexes, and this is the private garden. And we had to literally strip the entire building back to the frame and put in this new fenestration. The original fenestration was like that, and we fought hard to really simplify it with this sort of frieze at the top, because we felt that the status had changed. It wasn't these small apartments, and the planners were actually very supportive, whilst the residents were very unsupportive. On the front, the building has, again, that simple fixed light this time, which again acts as a corona on the northern side. This northern side is fixed entirely, and the southern aspect is openable, entirely openable. So if I go back, this whole elevation completely opens. So each set of windows completely open, so that it's a completely open facade. And the roof really plays with this, you know, the view on the roof is obviously these magnificent sort of chimneys which march all the way down. And in a way, I sort of saw these as a kind of new landscape of this sort, but and they were made very precisely. We, you know, we got fantastic lead workers to make traditional lead work and contemporary glazing details. And these sort of volumes illuminate and articulate the spaces that lived in below. So going on to this sort of terrace space, there's the terrace in the park and the relationship to that. And this is a sort of an automatic sensor, so it sort of opens and acts as a lighting sort of reflector for this space, which allows the living room, when it's completely open, to dissolve and sort of connect to this. This is the kitchen here, and the bedrooms are here. So this is just looking at that relationship. This is the kitchen, which slips, and then the living room is here. This is a sort of bead blasted stainless steel, just to tonally connect to this. This is a Portuguese limestone, and it's lining the entire volume. And then when you come in, this is the kitchen area, living, and the connections to this. Now this is engineered so that it's absolutely open jointed here and mortar jointed there. But this is about allowing air conditioning and all these things that are about the kind of contemporary condition to work. So this is a return air plenum system, and this obviously is the sort of solid floor. But the jointing sort of is used as a device to sort of articulate that so that that goes away. And what you get is the space when you look back. This is the window to the north, fireplaces, main room. Round. This north elevation is also the first facade, I guess, external facade that we know of. This was done 3.5-4 years ago, which has this opaque wall. So it sort of becomes opaque. The entire north wall can become opaque at the touch of a button, and the south wall becomes translucent. So this is a kind of incredible control of the environment and a kind of incredible use of technology to temper the environment between the outside and the inside. And at moments here, the entrance skylights with mirrors, very Soane-like, are sort of used to collect specific shafts to announce certain areas. Then library area, which is this moment when the timber sort of bleeds into the stone environment. These walls are, there are always these light walls so that there aren't any main lights. These are sort of reverse chandeliers, so in a way they're sort of cupolas which light up and have daylight coming through them, and also artificial light to light the rooms. And that junction where this landscape changes from this stone wrap to a sort of lane-like quality, where you have different types of smoked oak, which is black, sort of the tannic acid in the oak really kind of acting as a kind of figure for the environment. And this is this corridor, which should be dark, but is absolutely skylit. So along this dark corridor, you can see the sky, and that's the principal bedroom, and two small bedrooms on this side. Sort of on turning into one of those bedrooms, these are the bedrooms. I mean, this is shown without anything, but this is a sycamore room, and this is the idea of the timber, a single timber being unveiled around you. So really you're looking at the book matching of the entire sort of timber piece. And the beds are made in the same timber. And bathrooms off that. And this is obviously the light and the night light. And this is the wall that goes transparent to clear. And then on the south side, they have completely openable walls, which completely connect. So you could be sleeping and be completely in the treetops in the park. And then in the master bedroom, it becomes about a Macassar ebony, which is unveiled around the space. So in a way, almost subtly, not really noticing the difference between the smoked oak and this, but in a way, this becoming a very precious wood, which just surrounds the bed area. And then a bathing area behind it, which becomes a sort of a room for sauna, showering, and bathing, with a very large skylight to see the sky. And in a way, that's probably the most luxurious project we've ever done, and I doubt if we'll ever do another one that's as luxurious as that. We were all sort of astounded at the sort of, we would propose. It was not easy. We would propose, but our client would, you know, would want it. And I think it's been sold recently for a very large sum of money, which we just found out about, which shocked us all. But, somebody else has moved in and is very appreciative, and they've been very what usually happens in London is people come in and they tear it out and they move their stuff in, and what they've come in and sort of phoned us and they want to kind of, you know, talk to us about anything they'd like to do, and it's incredibly sweet. And we're just like, sure, we're, you know, real pleasure. The next house really starts to move more north. This is actually, and it's McGregor House. I've never shown this house, actually, and this house is about 6 years old, one of the first houses I did. And this is in St. John's Wood. This is the sort of St. John's Wood neighborhood. So again, looking at this other grain of London, where you have these incredible terraces and these incredible main roads, Boundary Road, sort of intersecting, sort of just here. This is the sort of topology of that environment, which very grand, semi-detached sort of townhouses, very large, which have now been divided into flats. So these typically become fantastic flats. Ground floor has garden and very nice principal rooms in there. Top. And you know, you have different scales of that, but essentially the same topology. And they were, you know, they've been incredibly flexible. They have allowed a sort of incredible flexibility in terms of sort of reuse of that from townhouse to, you know, different levels of affordability. But what's been interesting is then getting a client, and this is another one where you occasionally get a freestanding house in that terrace configuration, which adds sort of punctuations and articulates the grain of the of that part of the city. And occasionally you get, you know, a quirky, you know, a Gothic revival sort of detached, and it somehow works really well. And here, the project becomes about how to make one of these half detached townhouses, which had been carved into apartments, back into a home again. And what does that mean? And of course we could very easily just make the principal room, you know, the kitchen, the kitchens, and, you know, the servants were downstairs, have the bedrooms upstairs, etc., and have sort of nannies in the attic, etc. But what this offered was an opportunity to look at the house, and this becomes something that I start to look at a lot later on in other projects, this idea of a kind of contemporary, what is the contemporary of condition of this? And for me, the idea that there's a couple who still, you know, have had children, have, you know, several children, and still want their sort of, and are still very much in love with each other, and still kind of want that intimacy that they felt when they first moved into their first apartment, and, you know, and had that kind of incredible intimacy in that, and maybe where that's where the strength of their relationship was kind of really forged. So the idea was to make in this a kind of a remaking of a small house, which is at the top of the building. So the house is completely gutted, and a sort of small house made here inside this apex, house-like apex of the attic is made as a small flat for sort of the parents. Then there's a sort of sleeping bedroom floor which connects very directly to that. And then there's a sort of principal room which is seen as a sort of study library. And then there's a large family room with, you know, the traditional English thing of having a conservatory, but that's really kind of pronounced volume, which then deals with the garden. So you have this cutting up of the plan of the building into a series of living plates, living zones. So essentially this thing is completely new on the inside. Traditionally you'd have a stair which would dogleg, and then you'd have a series of units which would split into sort of two principal rooms there and a principal room at the back, and then the stair doglegging here. What we've done is to, as you come in from the ground, to make an immense staircase which takes you straight down and offers you the conservatory, which is a dining room, and into a large family room which has light from both aspects and connects to the garden with sort of utilities and washing facilities down here. And then upstairs, this is this sort of flexible library living space with sort of movable wall which can make it into two rooms. Then up into three sort of principal bedrooms and a sort of small nanny bedroom here. And the staircase then takes a kind of long section and sort of dives up and runs into this space, which is this apartment that I was talking about, which is a sort of parents' apartment, which becomes a study, little living area with a fireplace, a bathing area, little office for them, an outdoor terrace, and up to a sleeping platform, which is absolutely in the sky. So, if you can see it, the sections. That's the back and that's the side. It's very difficult to see, but essentially it's really just working with the existing figure and adding to that. But this is the important section where that's the family plate, the extension, the kitchen, this new staircase and how it diagonally cuts the plan to the sort of top, the sort of attic, which is up here. This is the house, this is 10 Carlton Hill. It's a very simple oak door. It's full of technology, but the idea is to simplify it, and we had so much trouble making it work. front door, it's just lined in slate on the ground, and just really very simple details. But you walk in, and that's the first view. This is the stair which takes you down, and it's overexposed here, but there's a very large skylight just here, and this is a sort of little sort of precipice which looks over that, but we look at that, that's the conservatory down there. As you move forward, as you go down the stair, you're offered a view to the landscape and you sense that light just coming through. At the bottom of that, you sort of get this moment where you come out of the sort of section and you realize that you sort of moved outside of the plane of the building already by that staircase, and you're looking back at the building, and that's the light up above. And then you walk into the family room, which is through here. This is the family room, with a large kitchen, a chalkboard, sofas, and sort of glazed storage elements which light up and act as a sort of ambient light for the space, simple terrazzo flooring. So this is it, sort of empty, a fireplace, which is incredibly important. The whole space is made, the kind of idea here was to make the frame, the existing fabric of the building, out of a natural plaster, and to then insert a series of components, elements, furniture pieces, which either line the walls or disconnect and become elements within the space as a kind of way of layering the sort of, obviously the obvious past of the building and talking about the contemporaneous, the newness of the new things. It's very simple fireplaces. And this has a direct connection to the garden. And then the conservatory with, again, an opening wall. It's a sort of glass box, but with various devices that sort of tune it. This is a light source here. So this glows at night as a kind of sort of aperture, an auricular, which frames the table. And you sort of get this moment where you contextualize the sort of surroundings. So you are, it is a kind of architectural glass box. It's not a glass box, but it's just trying to disappear to try and say that, you know, it's not there. It's really something which frames the landscape for you. And that's looking back. So you get this moment where there's a slice at the bottom of the building, so this dark basement becomes this very bright room. And going back in, this is this moment overlooking that double height space. Looking back up, this is a bathroom, the clear window. And then up the stair and engaging the second stair, which starts to take you up into the private areas, but into that living room library. Through a corner, it's the library. Sort of looking back at that when that's open, so this becomes a kind of very flexible place which can allow for entertainment to occur on this floor without disturbing the private rooms upstairs or the family room downstairs. But it becomes a large diaphanous plate which enjoys the light from both aspects, and then up to this level, and this is that long stair up in the sort of the bedroom suites with bathrooms, it's just the bedroom corner. And you can just sort of see this idea, these furniture pieces which either line or calibrate the space, natural plaster. So sort of add a bit of lighting. Back out, up that stair to the top, and this is this attic space with this element here, which is a maple volume. This is this house that sits at the top of the house, and it's this winding stair to the bed platform, which is up here. This is dressing, and this is a sort of little living room. Bathroom where we, Ewan's Scottish, so we found Edwardian castle bathtubs and reglazed them. But we found a pair and put them underneath the large light and enclosed it in a sort of concrete tray with a sort of shower. And you sort of have this twin thing happening, which then looks back at the space. And then looking back, that's the terrace, which is through here, up this stair to this landing. And you are in this space where sort of the four lights. Four sort of four kind of lights are kind of surrounding you in different scales. And then the bed, which then has this fantastic view window, which opens completely to the sky. And then that's the terrace, which is sort of planted now, and it's a sort of private terrace off that living space. And then, so if that was, if this is working with this kind of incredible luxury, then working with this idea of sort of reconfiguring this townhouse, remaking the townhouse again, this is a very unusual project which we recently completed, which hasn't been published, but is an important project for me, where our client sort of bought a site which is not the typical topology. It's just sort of on that edge. It's in King's Cross. It's in that edge of regeneration. So it's a place where there's a kind of new, an opportunity to reconfigure what is, or to understand a new kind of dwelling possibility. My clients are in the fashion industry and in the shoe business, but they wanted something which is not about a standard home, not a loft. And they work both at home, and so the house becomes something that is an extension of their public life as well as their private world. So it's this very curious blurring of this public, the publicness coming into the private realm. So that's the canal, that's York Way. These are the sheds, the St. Pancras sheds. And the site is here. This is a sort of character of that area, which really is about large-scale warehouse buildings, which obviously were built around the canal to deal with sort of loading and receiving, and has now been turned into, I mean, this is DGW's offices, so it's been turned into sort of designer, architects, and sort of fashion people's offices. But, and this is a sort of figure of that landscape. So this couldn't be more, you know, it's so different to the sort of terrace topology of London that we understand. But it's interesting how it's also become a desirable place to have residences, and this is the building which this part of this building has been sort of converted into a residential building with a sort of large extension, which is more residential-like up above. And this is the site that my clients bought, which is essentially a loading bay of the factory, which was the most unusual sort of possession, you know, buy I've ever heard anybody make. It's just sort of like bought a loading bay and said, we want to put a house there. This is sort of the back. Planners made them put this in front of it when they converted the whole thing, but essentially this was just a screen to stop this sort of large porous elevation being too incongruous with the sort of new residential quality of this block. So essentially we had to really understand a project which obviously had no real sort of specific aspect in that traditional London street sort of quality that we understand. There's no boulevard of trees, there isn't that kind of fantastic setback. It's the York Way, which is one of the busiest thoroughfares up to North London, which is that view I just showed, and it has this quiet side on the back. But essentially all the light comes from above. And so this is a kind of very introverted house, and in a way, and something which receives light, and also all the views from all the neighbors are down. So really, how does one make a house in this sort of condition where, you know, the ideas of overlooking and all these very sensitive issues are absolutely become very heightened? And for me, the project became, and what was nice is they bought, that's the loading bay, just diagrammatically, and they bought the sort of the docking area of the loading bay, which is here, which is slightly raised. And that, for me, was the sort of clue to the project, really, which was to just make this twin sort of Janus-like world, which would join here and sort of cross over in this sort of area. But you would have this sort of light and dark space that would sort of join here, and a water element, which would sort of be the third element of this whole thing. It's a fantastic sort of nearly 6,000 square foot plate, and that sort of luxury seemed incredible. They didn't have a lot of money, but what they wanted was something completely different to the figure that they were seeing in London. So what we made was a house which understands light almost like a sort of periscope of a submarine. So it's sort of a house which has light courts and light scoops, which collects light from up above, and sort of and uses lenses, mirrors, to sort of refract the view and the light into different parts of the building. It's breaking up a bit, but that's the most important thing, which is the roof plan. There are three principal courts, one here, one here, one here, and then there are these skylights, which are in between, another skylight here. And then you basically have a series of bedrooms here, the living space here, and a small changing room, and then a swimming pool buried deep in the project, almost like a sort of cave, just here.
And these courts, just thematically, I sort of said this was a kind of air court, this idea of an oxygenating court, this a water court in the center of the building, and then an earth court, really a planting court here. I probably can't see it, but that's the elevation. That section's a little bit better. This is just cutting through the living plate, where it's a large space around these court, these voids, and one element of a sort of casting is made to kind of describe the living process, really. It's a sort of machine for living, I guess. This is a kitchen, which becomes storage, and then a sofa, and it articulates itself throughout the entire space. And then there's a sort of office up here, garage here. And then on the other side, this is the court, the main light court, front, and studio at the back. Looking at the section, which is probably more important, this is the pool here, which is elevated. There's a tank with a window. This is the bedroom with a kind of light scoop which collects light from this light well here. So light is coming in here, dropping here. But from this point, you have this fantastic perception. These are mirrors. You can see, even in the depth of this thing, the elevations of this building. And this is the sort of living plate. This is a lightweight timber construction. And this is a solid sort of insertion, a sort of lining in the sort of fabric of the building. So this is the new elevation. This was that gray wall. So you have this lightweight construction expressing itself on the facade. And there's a new door which we made, which we cut here. So this is the entrance, and this is a sort of just a large window. This is looking face on, and you suddenly see this kaleidoscopic effect of the lights sort of all compressed and layered up. The entrance, and realizing that actually you suddenly enter a dark space as opposed to the normal figure of entering a light space, but a dark, luminous space. And then this is that air court that I was discussing with these mirrors. So you have this space which has a black resin floor, stained, sort of recycled cheap laminate timber with lights inserted. This cast piece, which looks uncomfortable, but it's got leather on it and it's a comfortable piece. This is the central court with these bedroom light scoops. Going back, the kitchen figure, a little sort of TV area here. Looking back at that, the kitchen, this is a little office up here. It's that little office, which is the only moment you get sort of a white paint, and then that's looking back at the space right to the front. Little bathroom, the little earth court before it's planted. It's got little cabbages now on it. It's incredibly beautiful. This is a sort of TV film room. It's a sort of big daybed with sort of DVD stack here and a projector which comes down here. So this is before the daybed was fitted, but this is a large bed, essentially, which is at the floor level. It's the kitchen. Looking back at that air court, just details of the structure. And then going back into the bedrooms, and the bedrooms become these color fields. This is a sort of, it's difficult because of the slide, but it's a kind of, it's a very light green, a sort of O'Donnell green, and it gets slightly darker as it goes around. There are about 8 shades of it right around the space with a sort of carpet which is made to the same color. And then here the concrete structure is just exposed and the timbers which come through exposed. And this is the light scoop which collects light into that bedroom, and so do these. And then the principal bedroom is a kind of subtle, sort of plum, purpley. You know, again, there are about 8 shades of this sort of articulating each wall, and then the floor. Very high space as an entry sequence, then the bedroom space with the sort of collector here. Sort of seeing the color. So this is this moment where you suddenly see through dressing pool. Pool is a kind of tank, and there's that window, 2 windows, one at the end, which is the entry sequence, and one looking through the bedroom, purple. And this is the light that illuminates that pool. And then the top, where you suddenly understand the figure of this building and these apertures which collect light. And this is a moss garden, which has just been laid but will flower as well. So this is a sort of the trade back to the neighbors. They have a flowering garden to look down onto, and we can collect light. And then back into the space. And then looking out these mirror lenses. And then
Then another house that we worked in sort of brought us to Islington, and sort of in Islington, it was really about this idea of the Georgian house and the sort of myth of the Georgian house, a really beautiful topology in terms of elevation, the sort of reductive power of that elevation, the proportion of the windows, but really a sort of myth in this part of Islington because the plan type is incredibly small. So this is this part of, this is just typical, this is the aerial view of that area of Islington. You have these Georgian topologies, but these are incredibly narrow, you know, just under 5 meters. But the incredibly handsome as a kind of rows, terraces, but actually what you find is that they become about the staircase being the dominant figure, and then the rooms being quite small. And what was interesting for us was to try and work with this topology and investigate one dimension of, an incredible dimension within this confining set of proportions. So if that's the sort of typical figure of the house, the idea was to make one space which would give this sort of exhalation almost, this incredibly generous moment in the entire house, which really is about kind of living more or less on the stair and running up and down, which happens in muse houses as well in West London. So you get this moment where this is the typical floor plan, and then you have this moment where it suddenly becomes that. So from the sort of coal cellars right through to the edge, this whole thing is excavated and remade as a kind of large diaphanous plate. This is the existing end of the building. We moved it out to here. And in a way, this is all conceived as one room, as you'll see. And then you have bedrooms, which follow the traditional footplate, which is the large stair, and then the two rooms all the way to the top. All right, these plans haven't come out very well. That's the section here. It's a sort of elevated. What it was is that essentially it was up this at this height, and we've excavated the entire thing down and made an elevated mound at the top, which is a sort of barbecue space. This is a kind of play space. Glass conservatory, and then this family room here, and then the rest of the house is refurbished. This is the house here. This is the entry, and no surprises, really. We had to remake and re-strengthen most of this and sort of finish the moldings. And then that's the moment where you start to see what's happening. We made a cut just here, which then gives you this view to what's happening. When you go into the rooms, this is the sort of size of the room. So this is one room, library, and a desk, and that's it. And you can barely move around. This becomes 2 foot if we're lucky. You know, it's five, more like foot and a half space on either side, and that's the view out. So there's a kind of grandeur to the rooms, but there's a kind of miniaturization of their real scale, which is intriguing, of this part of Barnsbury. Upstairs, we've just made a series of linings and storage systems, which just allow the house to sort of breathe, so the children's rooms just have color walls, or upstairs, they become very simple storage elements. And then down, as you come from that view I was talking about, this is the view into this space that I was discussing. This is the old ground line, which is relined. Sorry, just go back. And you have this sort of large, continuous space, which I shall talk about in a second. When you come down, this sort of, that's the view we just came through. This is the stair we came down, the view we're looking at. And this is the sort of kitchen, little sitting area here with the fireplace. And then this is the sort of home. And we used here a Venetian stone, a basalt, to really make a sort of tray to sort of hold this space. And then what you get is this moment where the entire wall is made into a hydraulic plane so that opens and becomes a canopy extension, a kind of a way of further extending the interiority into this exterior. It sort of takes a minute and a bit to open. But there's the dining room. It's a heated floor up to about here, so that you get a bit of a microclimate here. And there's a slot for the water, and there's a fountain, and there's a herb garden here. This is the thing up. So you get this moment suddenly in this Georgian sort of architecture where you get this incredible horizontal, and there's the street there, and it's right through back. Well, this was made just before wireless got sort of became mainstream, so we had this cabled to be able to kind of use your internet, kind of go out there and work on the internet, and almost a year later wireless was everywhere, and it was a hilarious moment where technology was faster than anyway, staircase up to a mound. This is a sort of cedar
barbecue cooking area with a fig tree in it. Just sort of this room that can exist at the top of the building. This is this room with jasmines which grow around it. And then sort of back into the house, kitchen area, again, themes that you've sort of seen, this idea of using the storage element to not wanting to have lights coming down on your head, but really just using the storage element as both the glow element and making the kitchen element as part of the entire surface of the entire experience, the outside and the inside, at night. And then up above, and really this is the kind of typical garden condition on this level, and this is the excavation, and so this, you have this sort of new recalibrated urban garden. And what was interesting was they were frightened about their children using this, and this is now the most popular place for children here, that they just cycle and wheel around and they play with the fountains, and it's extraordinary how the actually a space which was not configured as a child space is actually incredibly friendly for children. It becomes a sort of landscape for them to just play whilst the mother is cooking and overlooking with the canopy open. Another project sort of which sort of looks at this sort of edge condition, which is similar to the, in a way, to this idea of reusing industrial buildings rather than residential buildings, is this what we're calling the Fog House. And this is a house in Clerkenwell as well. And it really was using an area where there's a kind of light industrial topology. And that topology is then sort of reconfigured to become, I mean, I guess what became very popular in that area, sort of loft-style houses. But this is a small sort of, almost looks like a printworks building, I believe. And it was owned by an artist. It was used as an artist's studio for a long while, and then this artist sold it to my client. And my client's a writer, a broadcaster. And it sort of becomes a sort of home, working environment, again, living space. This is, again, the grain of the area, large warehouse buildings, new buildings. This is an elderly home which has been built next door. So this is the sort of new architecture. This is the type of buildings that are in that area. This is directly opposite. So you have this very interesting, sort of really good proportioned industrial, light industrial buildings. And this is the building that my client bought. And what was very nice about it is that it has a fantastic aspect to this fabulous church and the courtyard of the church. But it has incredible proximity to all the windows from these office buildings, which are all looking in, and this rear, which obviously doesn't enjoy it, there's these office buildings with this incredible overlooking. This is that new housing, which abuts it, and that's the block here. And for me, the project became about trying to make a singular focus to that house and trying to, again, explore this idea of the living plates, but these living plates as a series of trays which slip in and out of the figure of the sort of grain of the old building and sort of lunge, as it were, towards the view. And the two sides of the building, which are the existing facades, are etched, so there is no view where they collect light, and what you have are the clear moments only happening on the end. So it just becomes this relationship to another part of the city, but not just as an incidental one, but one which looks at it from the ground right up to the rooftop. So it becomes always this way of kind of understanding a certain sort of quality in the house. The plan sort of divides very simply into a leisure space, a sort of training gym area on the basement. You come in, this gym area, there's a little office, a little garage here, up a stair, an office here with a terrace, covered terrace, up again, a sort of sleeping suite, just bed, bathing, dressing, bathroom, and then up again and putting the living room as a top plate with an outdoor terrace, an open terrace on the roof. So what it becomes is that's the existing figure, and this is the new building, which is, so the roof, the whole thing again is excavated, and this new building is inserted. That's the roof pavilion, and this is the extensions. That's how it sort of manifests itself there, around. The section, the staircase is moved right to the front. The staircase was at the back before, but we move it to the front and sort of open up the windows, so it becomes this journey up to that pavilion at the top. That's the sort of gym area, office, covered terrace, sleeping, and then. And then this is the new project. The house, this was the original entry, it's now entered. At the front, next to the stair. The staircase occupies this spot here. It's stained with a sort of, in a way, I sort of wanted to kind of work with this idea of when you remake new brickwork, you know, there are tricks to sort of trying to blend it in to make it look like it's sort of got the sort of soot from 100 years ago, but I like this idea of just exaggerating that and really sooting the entire building. So after we repaired it, instead of having this patchwork of the sort of fascination with the blonde, sort of blonde brick, you get just a sooting of the entire thing, and it becomes a kind of mask for what is actually the real building, which is this black smoke glass, etched glass volume, which inserts itself and actually talks about the view behind. So really just going in, I won't show too many pictures, up the stair, made with very simple materials, MDF, lacquered, but all this is about is just a coiling stair and enjoying the windows. Up to the top, this is the office, little screen for a sofa here, the desk is here, and a terrace out here. That's the terrace moment, and seeing the church. Up the stair, the master bedroom with the dressing areas, the bed, and the view again. Up the stair, kitchen, one moment where the etched opens so you see the rooftops, the existing buildings, lights, and then that's the living space and outdoor terrace and the church again. It's the building at the back. And that's the building as you walk up the alley. So this moment where you understand it is this figure which opens out, and that the thickness of the mask is sort of revealed. Then another house which moves more to the East End, and I guess the house the next two houses are actually, I guess, well known, Dirty House and Electra House. Dirty House really becomes this moment where working with an existing area, an area which has a kind of very fantastic tradition of light industry, leather tradition, artisanal, you know, Wren was here, the sort of RA was established in this, you know, had a lot of RA artists were here. It's the area where Gilbert and George had their studios. It's also become the sort of Renaissance place for the new sort of British art, burgeoning British art scene. And essentially, this is Bishopsgate, this is this new redevelopment which is going to occur. This is the Bethnal Green Road, this is Brick Lane. And the house is sort of here. And it's right next to one of the most interesting social projects of the turn of the century. This is LCC, this is an incredible mansion block which is always got film crews around it all the time. Fabulous grade one listed a mansion block which works around this idea of a circus, which is a mound, really perfect ensemble, and it's still able to deal with the different sort of requirements that are being put onto it. This is the typical figure of the houses next to that mansion, that estate, which is sort of these light industrial buildings with large windows, and some moments where you have corner buildings. This is the building that we got. And this is one of those moments where it's ironic that the planners kind of said, oh, great, Mr. Ajay, you know you're trying to always build buildings. Why don't you tear this down and build something new? And my clients and ourselves decided that actually this was the one time we didn't want to do that, because in a way that kind of becomes a kind of positive action rather than this idea of being subjected always to the planning process as a way of having a kind of an intellectual position to how you make a new dwelling. It wasn't just to be arrogant, it was just to try and make a position where one would actually say that this is the one time when the figure is to be accepted. What is fabulous about this is the proportion, the general proportion is fantastic. There aren't many houses where you can get this incredible corner prospect, wide plinth, large, sort of large volume plate. And what we ended up doing is to make studios for them. They're making studio, their drawing studio in their offices, and then their residential building. The project became about, really, this for me became a very interesting moment where this, a real search for a new kind of topology, London, very specific London topology, which is also linked to a kind of tradition, I think, which happened in London, you know, with
the fantastic Leighton studio houses, which are in Hammersmith, you know, this fantastic row of terraces with these fantastic lenses. But the idea of making a kind of a studio home in the East End, which was not the figure of the terraces that you conventionally find, but something which had a distinct quality, which talked to the idea of the art practice as a way of signifying newness in the built environment, became a very simple project of really developing two narratives, a very deep sort of vertical space and a horizontal space, this becoming the studios, this becoming the living environment, this being modeled on the Royal Academy, which this is an 18-foot space, and it's being absolutely pictured to the sort of picture rooms of the Royal Academy as a deliberate device. And it's a way, a little joke, it's a little aspiration of an artist to sort of, you know, if you show in the Royal Academy, you've arrived. So there was a kind of rehearsal that's occurring in here all the time. And then this idea of something which is maybe more akin to California, really, is what people say to me. But it was this idea of actually living in London in a way that is not really expected, which is to live with the horizon of London, which I think is very rare to get in most parts of London because of the way in which the terrace works and the way in which the topography works. But at this part of the East End, you get the city with its sort of very vertical moment. And so that becomes a landscape which this thing takes advantage of. Plans are very simple, but they're sort of blurred out. But they take the figure of four rooms. You have an entrance sequence, a large golden section studio, a cube drawing space, and a little office which is buried in the center. And then you rise up, there's a small guest wing, and then you have a large open plan, very disconglobulated sort of plan where nothing is fixed. You have kitchen, living, bed, bath, all sort of floating in a sort of space. And then what that becomes is a little extension of brickwork that we put on top in this pavilion. This is the kind of figure of the area, a large door so that you can drive trucks straight into that studio to collect works and take them out. Sections of that, just looking at these two proportions. And then really this idea of having a balustrade that's the same height as our client so that they can be here and can be naked if they wish without anybody seeing them, but always the horizon being there, and that's the glazed wall of the building. And that's the new building. This is the street. And it was the first, it's really ironic, we used anti-graffiti paint to cover it as a kind of waterproofing coating to tie all the different differentiated sort of textures that were on the building. There was kind of a render base, if you remember, brickwork, and it was all loose. And the brickwork was very porous, spongy, absorbing a lot of water, single solid block wall. So we used this resin coating to really give a sort of waterproof coat, a raincoat to the brickwork, and also to kind of transform it and make this sort of black sort of form as a counter and an anchor to the sort of light forms which are here. This being a corner building, in a way trying to kind of really make a block which holds that corner and doesn't kind of dissolve. And it's really funny, since we've done this, there's so many other black buildings. It's sort of started a sort of little thing where this suddenly happened and there's another one around here, and it's sort of become this way of announcing the corner, and it's quite interesting how by just making it an act, it sort of has a repercussion which it goes far wider than you expect. The sort of windows were taken out. It is, again, another new building. It's a mask. The windows are flush on the facade. These are mirror tinted and etched on the inside. So people, you know, the traffic wardens do their hair and makeup in here. And you know, the hookers use it at night because it's still quite a lively area. It has... The reveals are very deep on the top, so the windows are flush on the inside, flush here, flush on the inside here. And you have this cantilever roof, which basically works by making a structure without columns, and to talk about the idea of glass as a compression material, not glass as a material that you just look through as a window, but glass as a kind of physical material that you use. I can talk about that a bit more later, just looking around the building. This is just the texture and tonality, this becoming the doorway, which is this idea of incredible discretion because this is extremely exposed. So there's no need to announce, really, to the street. It's an incredibly exposed street. And then that entry into the first space, which is this space which collects southwest light through these six windows. The studio, which is this incredible wall which we had to make. And if you know Tim Noble and Sue Webster, the artists, they make projections. And this wall is really a trial projector wall. It's a kind of large cinema wall to test out the projections. And then into the drawing studio, which is a space which takes north light and has a little outdoor courtyard just as a respite with a palm tree as a sort of
again, another little joke. London cobbles out here, just left as it is, and this, the sort of history is sort of covered under this resin and sealed, but that's kind of enjoyed as a kind of scarification almost of the building that's sort of left. Going up the stair to the private areas. At the top of the stair, this moment of seeing the horizontal kitchen, living, that's that horizontal that I'm talking about. This is the sort of glass as a kind of compression material. This is 60 millimeters glass with steel sort of plates embedded in the double glazing, so they take the loads of the roof down into that, into a sort of ring beam, which then transfers the loads down into the ground. But it gives this hover. And then the bedroom with the bed and its own light, bath, its own light, dressing and its own light. The terrace, which is nearly 3 meters on one side and two on the other, and large opening doors, which just dissolve this whole thing. It's the bedroom area here, it's just the living room. Coming round, this is the view. It's lit at the low point, so you don't see the sort of main source of light. So it's back to the east end, it sort of frames. That's that estate I was talking about at the beginning, which is just here. The house, and when that terrace light is on, you get this halo from the sort of whiteness of the interior. And at night, these become night lights, sort of urban lights. The mirrors become night lights on the street. And on the inside, there are edicules, just giant niches for Tim and Sue to do things. And this is the house in the evening. Another studio for another artist. This is the house for Chris Ofili. This is again in this East End and working within this East End. We're back to working within a very unusual topology where you have this East End grain. I mean, fascinating. That's the Hawksmoor Church here. It's Commercial Road. And this is Fashion Street. This is Fournier Street. So Gilbert and George are here. This is the famous sort of incredible Georgian Street. And this is sort of where the wannabes, or the new emperors are. Wannabes, that's very, sorry, I didn't mean that. I'll get slaughtered for that. well, you have, you know, gosh, there's an incredible amount of artists. I shouldn't anyway go into that. But anyway, Chris is here. This is the topology of the street, and it looks like it's supposed to be a residential street, but actually these are sweatshops. These were designed as shop units on the ground with sweatshops up above. But it uses a sort of Dutch Amsterdam gable sort of architecture to talk about this idea of a street life. But it actually was never meant to be homes. And this is fascinating. And opposite, this was a Jewish tabernacle and market and school, and it uses this Moorish architecture literally opposite this Dutch architecture. And this is London. I think this is London, and this is how London has sort of evolved. And next to that, warehouses. This is a project we ended up redoing, but this is a warehouse that we refurbished, which is further down, just a standard storage building. And here, the kind of the same discourse, which I've been looking at, is played out again, but this idea of how do you turn a sort of works building into a home. Again, the same problems of the narrowness of the footprint of this type of house, the fact that it forces you to just be sort of running up and down all the time, and really a way of making a space for Chris, his first studio. You know, he lived in a very small home before getting this, and it was about combining the studio production, which is sort of on the ground with a drawing space underneath, and living here, bedrooms, and his space up here. This time not being a box, but this time being a platform to the sky. Again, these plans, very tight, you know, it's kind of extraordinary when you look at these plates. The stock, the London stock, generally tends to have these very tightly planned, beautiful facades, but very small figures. And only when you sort of have the generous West London homes, you have these fantastic large plates. But this idea of opening this is the ground floor studio, this becomes an office, drawing room, a little courtyard, and then a large hall vestibule, which takes you up to a living space, kitchen, and a large terrace. This is conservatory dining here. And then bedrooms up above. And then the section, really. This is the street, the staircase. This is the only thing that's left. It's just a really beautiful concrete stair. that we repolished and kept, and the rest of it is remade. The studio is built. These were actually lanes with sort of little muse warehouses at the back, and carriages would run between the buildings collecting the goods and then going into the city. And what we've done is most of them have been filled, but we reconnected it, excavated it a little bit more to get a 15-foot space for Chris, and to use the sort of Parisian idea of a sort of lens light floor to get a diffused light into the studio. So we made a new facade. You saw the sort of facades that exist, sort of that I showed before, and this becoming just a very simple facade, which reveals the split of the sort of residential here and the sort of the public side of the home here. The whole thing opens to reveal Chris's studio, and then this is the house. And the idea is that the 8-foot paintings, 10-foot paintings can just slide straight into the main space. Sort of working environment, then the drop, and then the studio environment. And this uses this fluorescent and bulb light to just allow Chris to sort of calibrate the light levels or use the right kind of light that he wants to use to make the paintings that he's making. So looking back, this is the studio, this is the offices, and down into the basement. Just very simple polished concrete. This opens to allow you to get into the courtyard. And then sort of going up, the rest of the house again here is also made again with this luster plaster, natural plaster Paris, and then just waxed. And then the concrete stair is polished with all its stains and allowed to just be the sort of remnant tying the building together. Kitchen and living room, which opens to a conservatory, and this is a doorway, a very small doorway that slips out to a courtyard. Conservatory completely opens, a terrace with a bench which looks at the church. So this moment, when we got it, these were pigeon houses, these were completely derelict, and now Jake lives there and Dinos lives there. But we sort of cleaned this up, made this extension, and that's the connections back. At night, it's a fabulous terrace. It's a little outdoor yard for barbecues. The canopy goes across the whole thing, so this is an entirely covered area. This bench at the end and the Hawksmoor Church. Sort of going up, and this is that moment where the top is open, and this is the stair up to that. This is the bedroom area with the stair which takes you to the sleeping platform. Dressing rooms here with a little bathroom in here. It's almost like a design, almost like a sort of train, almost like being on a train, really, this sort of compartmentalization. There's actually a toilet and sink that you open, and it sort of closes the room off to make a sort of bathroom at the end. And then a sort of sleeping platform at the top, very close to a light, which obviously can shut, but also enjoys moonlight when you're feeling sleepless and need to think. This is the house at night. And then the last project, I hope you're not too tired. the Electra House, which again I think is quite well known, work of mine. Again, right in the East End, and this working back in a very residential part of the East End, in the terrace area. The hospital is just behind here. And the idea here was to really work in a street. Ashfield Street is a street which has very beautiful sort of Victorian terraces and also this sort of curious Dutch terracing which happened in the East End, which I should show, which you sort of get this moments here. This is opposite. So you have this white stucco, this deep terracotta brick with sort of terracotta mortar, so it really has a kind of redness to it, which was very influential to me in making this house. And then you have the sort of London stock terraces, all relieving arches, you know, very beautiful cottages, really. And I've sort of kind of showed you the figure around this area here, and this is my site, which was essentially a lean-to next to these terraces, and it was about making another studio home combination where, I mean, if the dirty house was much more separated, in a way, the site and the dirty house sort of became approximately 5,000 square foot's worth of sort of dwelling space. This really is just under 1,000 square foot's worth of space, sort of on different levels. And it's a lean-to site. It's a site which is used, supposed to be just a sort of small sort of production shed, which is at the end of these terraces. And what we did was to make really two volumes, a large volume and a smaller volume, which we can talk about. And the two volumes really
talking about this idea of the kind of a volume, which is about light and space of possibilities, and then a servicing element, which then is diagonally connected to that space. This being the sort of engine for the house in a way. This is the kitchen pod, and then there's a courtyard which mitigates those two. This is an outdoor space, and then a little dining space, which is a sort of the third link between these two things. And the idea was just to make a volume that acknowledges this terrace. It's very simply made. It's made for, you know, an extraordinarily... I wanted to match the sort of budget that Wimpy used for standard suburban houses. So, you know, for the beginning, I was working with a sort of budget, which is a sort of dream palatial budget. Here, the budget is about a sort of a standard house builder's home, but to kind of shift the possibility of what that could mean. I mean, I'm not saying this is a house that everybody should have, but in a way, what I was trying to say is that there's a kind of variety that you can have even at that scale of budget. It's incredibly difficult to do because nobody wanted to kind of do it. We had to force a contractor who we were working with on other projects who sort of yielded, sort of after being worn down. And the idea was to make a sort of compression, really, a form. This is the main volume, which has a suspended form in it, which becomes the sleeping destination. But this form, which actually becomes a way of calibrating north and south light, using a sort of light chimney on its north and a sort of clear story to enjoy what's, I mean, what's beautiful about the East End, which people forget in this area, is that the skies, unfortunately because of the bombing, it's quite horizontal and you have this incredibly beautiful sky. So, and the art, most of the artists I know are drawn to that and find that a really powerful draw for why they actually like this area as well. All the painters totally love this light. And these two artists are conceptual artists, but one of them works very specifically with light, so the discussion they came about collecting this light also. So the plans are, again, very simple. This is this unit here. This is the conservatory. This is open space. Then upstairs, you have 1, 2, 3, 4 rooms, sort of just as cubes with this idea of corridor being taken out. So they're just a series of rooms and a bathing room here, and then these two voids on either side. And these bedrooms enjoy small vignettes to the sort of party wall and then large skylights. The elevations, this is just the panel material, really this idea of the contextual relationship that that has, and then the glazed rear. So this is the street where you have the stucco, this brickwork, this Dutch Amsterdam terrace sort of style, and then this end block, which finishes this composition, as far as I'm concerned. There's one site here, and I think there should be another building here, and that'll be very nice. Nobody's done it yet. I think he's waiting for the right price, because he's seen what's... So this is the house. And, it, you know, I kind of was very interested in this idea. I recycled the existing footprint of that shed. We designed a structure with Nicanico. I mean, an engineer I absolutely loved, and it was so sad to, that he died recently. But he was a very important engineer that I worked with on all my early projects. And Nick was very important in teaching, really, this idea of an economy of structure and this idea of reusing, which I really... I identified with, and it has become a very strong part of some of the things that I do. But essentially, with Nick, we sort of decided to make a structure which would reuse the existing footings and put a lightweight construction on this building without requiring us to underpin the whole thing to make this new structure, and to use simple tricks like Walter Siegel's ideas about roofs being just trays of water which then overflow. And, you know, this is a photograph that was given to us by the neighbor who really loves this roof. And it's not our photograph, it was the neighbor's photograph, because he says he gets fantastic reflections off this thing and he just loves that. So it becomes part of the lecture. The house is just a volume. It's entered off the side, this alley, this junction between these two. On the street, it's this deep aubergine color. It's actually a deep aubergine. It's not a black facade. And it's made out of this Malaysian plywood with this resin film on the front. The entry, so it's made out of... Hello. Having a lecture. I'm nearly finished. concrete. It's made out of, without any materials, it's really a volume of light. This is the entrance, so you enter at the back. This is a conservatory moment. This is this conservatory here. Here it is here. That's the sort of the engine box, the kitchen, the volume here. The living room with this north light. Sorry, it's a bit bleached, but there's a kind of fantastic pulsating north light, which is very unusual. The north light has this frequency that once you reflect it down a sort of a light tunnel, you see the way in which it sort of pulses.
And it's here, it's large tunnel, it's a 7-meter void with large hydraulic skylights to allow heat to be released. So it's really cool in the summer and it's really warm in the winter, which is really great. It doesn't need much heat. The bedrooms up above, which are incredibly vertical because they're very small plates, so you have sort of 3.7 meter high room with these doors, which are the most bespoke part of this project, which is to make these doors and then to put them on hydraulic dampers so that there's a speed. The speed of the space is incredibly slow. There are no handles, that you just push them and then the doors just gently close. This is the window to the party walls I was talking about. And each light touches a wall, just so that the light is always drawn physically down. Master bedroom, a connection to the box room where the baby is. This is the hall, the house at the back, the south lantern, and that's it. Thank you very much.
David, thank you very, very much for that. I would like to maybe use 5-6 minutes to ask a few questions. But I mean, you know, there are a few. I talked about the notion of intensity and rigor and beauty. I didn't realize how much of it you've done. So really, it is incredibly powerful work. There are a number of issues which perhaps we can talk about in a moment. But I would like to ask for perhaps 2-3 short questions, and as ever, questions, not statements, and tell us who you are, and put your hands up, and the microphone will arrive. So are there any questions or comments? No comments, sorry, I said questions. hold on, one sec, wait for the microphone.
When you operate on an existing building, like in most of these cases, it seems. What does make you decide if to retain or substitute or even in some cases manipulate the part of the existing building in terms? It's more in respect of what you want to achieve internally in terms of internal space, or maybe more about the external context and the urban result.
I think I understand the question. I think at the heart of what I'm sort of interested in with the dwellings is an investigation of this adjusted topology. I mean, I really mean this. I'm very interested in the way in which the topology of the sort of existing fabric. I love the fact that we have a city. I mean, it's and there's a grain, so I enjoy the physicality of the city. What I'm interested in is trying to understand the kind of lives that people are living and to try and see how that imprints on the city and adjusts the city. So that for me is very, very important. So it becomes a very empirical exercise where I'm very fascinated in understanding the extent to which people's lives want to be kind of articulated in the frame of the city as it exists, and then to just sort of find a way of making that a kind of new topological sort of possibility for dwelling, which is then imprinted onto the kind of existing fabric of the city. And then the idea of adjustments or reconfigurations take place as a series of exercises which are tested against the fabric of the building. So it's not just necessarily about a kind of historical layering or revealing and talking about past and present, but more, it's maybe a little bit more, much more close than that. It's more a kind of much more melting of the present with the existing fabric of the city, and to try and find new ways. And if that means absolutely, you know, ripping it down to the point where only little bits are left, that's fine. If it means using fragments because they fit the programmatic idea, then that's fine. It's not ever about a kind of historicism of the building or a kind of an idea of making an image of the building. It's always about how this can impact the city in a very empirical way that, you know, obviously it's empirical and artistic, but I really like the idea that that collision occurs. I enjoy my clients sometimes say to me, do we just say, you know, do what you like, or should we tell you what we want? And I'm like, if you don't tell me what you want, I don't know what the hell to do. You know, I can't do a house for you. But I sometimes clients think that I'm sort of not, I'm being lazy or something, but it's for me very important that there's a kind of very articulated life.
because that's what's interesting about doing houses for me now, not my kind of sort of ascribing of what I think that thing should be, but actually understanding in a way as a kind of sociological phenomena the way in which people want to live their lives now, and to then find a way of calibrating that within the context that we have.
If I just take that point a little bit further, I mean, what you seem to be doing, and this is part of, in a way, the social and political program of London at the moment, is literally retrofitting the city.
Yeah.
I mean, you're engaging in digging in and retrofitting.
Rebooting.
And it's a very therapeutic process. I mean, actually, you're just looking at this work, you feel calm. I mean, it's quite when you go around these areas, you feel pretty nervous. And it's quite interesting what architecture can do. And I have to ask the obvious question, which you, I'm sure, get asked all the time, but you're dealing with single family situations. And it's interesting, you didn't show the Ideas Store, which is a new project, which in a way answers the question I'm going to ask you, which is how can you keep that wonderful controlled ability when you're intervening in the city at a bigger scale?
Yeah.
With a more complex program, with handrails which are given to you by the state rather than designed with the sorts of budgets you're talking about.
Yeah.
Even though you made the point of the budget very clearly, will you address that issue for us? Because I know you've thought about it and has been talked about.
Yeah. No. I mean, I deliberately didn't want to sort of. I wanted to kind of make this an opportunity to talk about the dwelling pieces. So these are. And I think that actually there's a kind of misunderstanding sometimes about these very bespoke projects that somehow they're just about coffee table sort of fodder or, but what I'm trying to say is that for me, these projects are really about real research that I think has a kind of real value to how you understand the existing condition of the city and how you make new things in the city. For me, these projects completely become the basis. I very much believe in a kind of practical theory where you make and then you learn from the making and you reapply the making back into the thing. So you can constantly recycling and constantly replacing back into the thing being the city, the work that you're investigating. So it's the jump to civic has been wonderful for us. I mean, we're enjoying it. I mean, I'm loving doing it. And for me, there is no disconnect to that intensity. And the requirements of the city, the complexity, all the things you're talking about, are actually more of the program that I need to actually calibrate the project. So actually, it's exhausting, and my team, have a lot of pain because we fight a lot to make this thing happen. But it's
one more question. One question here, second row.
Tony Travers from LSE. Mm. Your interventions in the streets, as Ricky said, are in their way dramatic, almost sculptural in the way that they move into the streets. And yet, perhaps compared with many architects, certainly those that I've sort of heard and read about, this is not... I mean, you made the point yourself that the planning department of Hackney or wherever it was saying, why don't you rip it down? And you were saying, no, let's just leave it, which is perhaps surprising in that London is often a city in which there are great struggles about should we knock the building down, should it be taller, should it be...
Yeah.
And it sounds as if, in a curious way, you're relatively conservative in that sense, but very radical with what you then do with the space. Is that a fair observation?
Well, I think... I call it what you want, but I...
So I don't mean that as a criticism.
No, I know. I mean, literally call it what you want. I think it's fine. I just like looking at the kind of physical fact of the city, whereas I think this polemic is always about this idea that somehow it's done or it's gone and we're not talking about that anymore and you're moving somewhere else. And I find that deeply disturbing because it polarizes the kind of real work that an architect does and it forces him to become a performer most of the time. And I think that this is really... a little bit of a misuse of the brain of an architect, really. The brain of an architect is to kind of calibrate and work, to make, the environments that, we require as sort of citizens.
I am going to have to draw the evening to a close. We're nearly at 8 o'clock, but, there's a sort of a wonderful circularity, talking at the beginning of setting up the city's program, to hear pure social scientists like Tony Travers to talk about beauty and articulation of space, and to hear a great architect talk about the need to engage with the grain of the city and to talk about his projects as social projects in many ways. So I want to wrap up this evening by obviously thanking David on behalf of myself, the LSE, and the Royal Academy, and just to remind us that it's not just a question of understanding poetics of the city, but by intervening, you actually create poetics in the city. Thank you, David.
Thank you.